I started this little series on the Atacavaga, mostly because my teacher, Gil Fronsdale, did a translation. Who was here 2 weeks ago? Good. Okay. Who wasn't here 2 weeks ago? Well, just as many. All right. So that doesn't help. I'm going to go over what I went over the first time briefly, not quite as long, on a little bit about our tradition and the Pali Canon. And the Pali Canon, which is the basis of Theravada Buddhism's way of looking at the world through the Buddha, through the framework of the Buddha, that's our source. And it is made up of three sections. And the first one is the Vinaya, and that is the code of conduct for monks and nuns. It also has lots of stories and instructions in it. The second are the suttas themselves, and that's what most of us quote from, which when we give Dharma talks and that kind of thing. And the last one is the Abhidhamma. And the Abhidhamma is kind of out of sync with the first two, with the Vinaya and the Sutta Pitaka, Pitaka. Rich, is it Pitaka or Pitaka? Yeah. So Abhidhamma was written, they think of maybe 500 years after the Buddha, and it goes into Buddhist psychology in great depth about what your mind does, mind minutes, that kind of thing. It's very dense. I know a number of people, Rich and a couple other people, have studied it. I haven't. I don't have enough patience because it's complicated. In the Sutta Pitaka, which is what I'm going to be talking about tonight, there are five collections, and they're called Nikayas, or books. And the first one is the Digha Nikaya. That is the long discourses. It is thought that perhaps these were the discourses used to convert people to Buddhist practice back in the day. The second is the Majjhima Nikaya, and those are the middle-length discourses. And they go into more explanation about the readings and the teachings of the Buddha. The Samyutta Nikaya is the next one, and it goes into even more detail. The Anguttara Nikaya are called the numerical discourses because this is where a lot of the numbering systems of the four of that and the eight of this, and that's where they can be found. And then we get to the Kutika Nikaya, which is considered by most scholars to be the oldest of the Nikayas. What got me interested was when my teacher wrote this translation of one section of the Kutika Nikaya. It's broken down into other subsections, one of which is called the Sutta Nipada. And out of the Sutta Nipada comes this. And this is the Atacavaga. Vaga means verses. And why they think these are probably amongst the very oldest of the Buddhist teachings is because of the way they are written. They're written in verse. And this was how people relayed information back in the day. There was no writing, except extremely limited writing by scribes of some kind, I imagine, for the pontiff or whoever is running things. But mostly it was just memorization and reciting to each other. And the verses in the Atacavaga are done in verse, so they're easy to memorize. And then to break it down even further, there's four of these that they think are the oldest, and they're called the Book of Eights, because they're eight verses each. Now why, when Gil did this, and I think it's really interesting, and I was just telling Rich, I've read about four translations of this, he actually kept it into eight verses, which is, he said, not easy to do. All the other translations I've read, just, you know, you just list it and translate it. But he actually tried to keep the verse effect, so you kind of get a feeling of what it was like back in that time. So these are the Book of Eights. There's four of them. I was talking about two of them, and one of them was 2 weeks ago, and I got a lot of comments about it and had a lot of discussions. Ended up talking to Bob Jennifer a good 15, 20 minutes after the sitting that night about how can you not have a view and live in the world, because this is what this particular Sutta was talking about. I'm just going to pick one section. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But those, this is the seventh verse, those who are cleansed don't form a view about states of becoming or not becoming anywhere in the world. Having abandoned illusions and conceit, by what means would those who are cleansed go to non-attachment? They are without attachment. And our discussion was, how can you live without a view? How is that even possible? And which led to a very interesting discussion. And then I get the new tricycle, and I open it up, and I happen to open it up to this page. Once we stop identifying with any view, we find that harmony is always there. Okay, and that was on Globalism 3.0. So I decided, because I am not a scholar, like some of you are, I have to put everything into my own experience to understand it. So I had an incident with an acquaintance who said something I didn't agree with at all. And not being mindful at the moment, I just didn't notice how a lot of negativity was coming up. A view was being formed. I caught myself because I noticed now I don't like this person as much. I don't like that view. And as I caught that, I also started reflecting on, but I have no idea why this person formed this point of view. I don't know their background. I don't know if the culture they were brought up in possibly promoted this view. Their parenting, lack of parenting, genetics, all the things the Buddha talks about that make up karma. I don't know what any of those are. And when I started realizing that, I felt my view drop. And that's when it hit me, I've become a better person because I've dropped a view. And then that started making sense. That whole sutta on don't have any view at all. It doesn't make sense when you say it, but it makes sense when you do it. It's experiential. And I really, really appreciate these teachings so much more. And I challenge you to do this. You know, it might not make sense, but just try it yourself. Just see what happens with some of these teachings. And I think you'll get some amazing results. So, as I mentioned, I read four translations of the Adhikavagga and the Sutta Nipata, and I was just telling Rich, you know, the views on how people believe they should be translated are so different as well. I couldn't even tell. I was reading the same thing. One was written by a secular Buddhist, Stephen Batchelor, who has definite view on how things should be, as does Thanissaro Bhikkhu, an Orthodox Theravadan monk, who has a definite view on how things should be, and their translations show that as well. So I think Gil does a great job. He obviously has a view as well, but I think he tried as best he could to get to the essence and the flavor of what is going on. So a lot of modern commentators, and actually ancient commentators, when they read the Adhikavaga, wonder if the Buddha even wrote them, because they are so different, and the languaging is so different. In fact, when we read this particular one, one of the first questions I'm going to ask you is, do you think the Buddha wrote this or not? Don't cheat. You can't read it yet. Jerry's quickly reading it. And some people say that it was different authors, different disciples, different people who had a different take on the Dharma, and they came up with their own verses. Others say that the Buddha himself did these, and as we all know, when he talked to different audiences, to different people, he reframed how he was speaking for that particular audience. He spoke differently to his monastics than he did with lay people. He spoke differently to the nuns than he did to the monks. So it could be him, you know, speaking at different times in different situations. Gil Fronsdale says in his commentary to the Adhikavaga, many concepts that are now identified as Buddhist were already current in the early Vedic treatises. So a lot of, and I was frankly surprised as I'm studying this, a lot of things that I thought were very original were not. The Buddha appreciated, according to Gil, the Upanishads, the Vedas at the time, not all of them obviously, but some of them he definitely adhered to, and especially, Gil says, the Upanishad of the Great Forest. Interesting, we're of the Thai forest tradition. And the Upanishad of the Great Forest talks about renunciation and not grasping onto anything, even views. So one of my favorite sayings right now is, a proponent of the Dharma does not dispute with anyone in the world. How difficult is that? It's really, really a challenge. And so this one, that was what we talked about 2 weeks ago. This one is called the Guhataka Sutta. Now, Guha in Pali, I have learned, means hiding place. Stephen Batchelor said it means a cell or a cave. Another translation means it's the body of yourself. You can see it's all over how this is translated. So what I'd like to do is, whoever can, who would like to read the first verse, to come up here, face everybody, and read that verse just like we did 2 weeks ago. So who is, and the rest of us, I'd like you just to listen as mindfully as you can. I'm going to ask you a series of questions about what you think this interpretation is. This is another paradoxical verse and study. Okay, so who's going to read the first paragraph? Okay. You can go second, Bob.
For someone sunk in confusion, even if well concealed in a hiding place, seclusion is far away. In this world, it is not easy to let go of desires.
Thank you. Okay.
Hard to free are those tied to wishes and bound to the charm of existence. Surely one isn't liberated by others.
Longing for what has been and what can be, they hunger for sensuous pleasures that they have had, greedy, stingy, attached, and obsessed with desires, they are wedded to disharmony. Presented with suffering, they lament, "What will happen to us when we pass away from here?"
Therefore, you should train right here. Don't do what you know is out of harmony with the world. Life is short, say the wise.
I see people thrashing about in the world, thirsting for states of existence, not freed from craving, becoming, and non-becoming. Lowly people weep in the face of death.
I see people thrashing about in the world, thirsting for states of existence, not freed from craving, becoming, and non-becoming. Lowly people weep in the face of death.
See them thrashing about in their selfishness, like fish in tiny puddles of a dying stream. Observing this, live unselfishly, not forming attachments to becoming.
We have someone for verse 7.
Subduing desire for both sides, fully understanding sense experience, free of greed and doing nothing one would reproach oneself for, a sage does not attach to what is seen or heard.
And last paragraph.
Fully understanding concepts and having crossed the flood, sages don't cling to possessions. With arrow removed, living alertly, they do not long for this world or the next.
Okay, so that's easy. Not too much going on there. So this is these initial teachings. There's no dogma. It almost sounds like it's coming excruciatingly from the heart. I know it gets to me. You can almost feel the pain that this person is going through, which leads to my first question. Is this the Buddha? Who thinks it is the Buddha, or is it not the Buddha? And why?
I don't think so.
Why not?
Not why, it's not as wise as I would imagine from the Buddha. Somehow, he's always enlightening. At least that's what I find. You know, he'll offer, you know, a vision of something that is really to aspire to. But here we're talking about all that which limits our possibilities, because so focused on the greed, hatred, and delusion, so much of it, and he might have. Well, I don't know if I'm. I don't think I'm right now.
Teaching's working.
Yeah, Barbara.
Well, to me, the thing, I don't know if this is a function of the translation or of anything else. The style is very different than what I'm familiar with in the suttas, especially in the verse. I mean, it's definitely, I would call it poetry, and the imagery. You know, the Buddha uses examples, but they're not. The imagery is quite different.
Yes, absolutely. This is also why they think these are very, very ancient. And they actually think these were written at the time of the Buddha. one of the very few portions of the Pali Canon, and the reason is because many of the expressions were used by the Jains then that you don't find later, and also Vedic expressions that you don't find later that were completely abandoned.
But there are some references that are very similar, you know.
Yes.
Like in the last verse.
Yes.
With arrow removed. Mm-hmm. I mean,
that Rich just gave a talk on. That's right.
Gave a talk on the arrow, and there was another. I mean, there's others of which there are either echoes in the in this or in the later one. So the concepts, you know, the non-attachment concepts are certainly very familiar with the what's in the suttas.
I heard one translator say these are, I think it's primordial. Yeah. Because, as you just said, there's concepts that we see later developed that are mentioned here, but not fully developed.
Right.
Raphael, did you want to say something?
What jumped out at me is Buddha nature is not necessarily, to me, trying to get me away from any of the attachments, or for me, the problems that I face in my life, not trying to get me away from it. And what I got from the verses was, if I can be deaf, dumb, and blind, and I'm not going to be worried about anything. And Buddha nature is not trying to ask me or trying to get me to be deaf, dumb, and blind, but to be aware and to accept and to be mindful. Mm-hmm. And so being mindful will have me in a state of not being fooled either way.
Yeah, which is another concept that has developed even more and more as time went on. In fact, what you're saying, what I saw out of this also was the beginning of the Second Noble Truth. He talks about sensuous desire, he talks about becoming and not becoming. So, craving, tanha, craving to become, bhava tanha, and craving not to become, abhava tanha. And all of these are not to be attached to, but they're all there. I think also, and tell me what you think about this, the very first verse, even if well concealed in a hiding place, seclusion is far away. Mm-hmm. In this world, it's not easy to let go of desire. So what is he saying about seclusion? What does that mean? Yeah, right.
Well, I think he's talking about the idea that you can be away from the world physically, but still very much attached to it.
Yes.
That's something that comes up again and again in one of the other books that Gil also translated. I'm blanking on the name right now. Just, I don't know. It's kind of like, it's one of the, it's not one of the longer series, it's one of the very short ones. But anyway, that concept is referred to there as well.
I think that seclusion is a key to all of this. It sounds like seclusion in this instance is a deeply personal mental struggle of some kind. When I read this, I was reminded of a teacher, and I mentioned this to John Sittery the other night, who at a retreat, and this teacher, I can't even remember the teacher, I just remember them saying, every one of you in this room has a secret you don't want anyone to know. Every one of you. And you're ashamed of it. And everybody is. And it was true. And that kind of reminds me of the seclusion, being at that place where there's no hiding that, whatever it is that comes up, and it could be on a retreat, it could be taking a walk, it could be who knows what. For me, that's what that seclusion meant. You know, allowing that thing that you keep tamped down the best you can, and it comes up. And you got to face it. Now what do you do with it? So that's, you know, my own feeling about this is this is not the Buddha, or it's a immature Buddha. A Buddha who is also not fully cooked. You know, which I guess is anathema to, you know, being here. Yeah, Bob.
Well, that's what I was wondering. This is like an early stage of the Buddhist thought, that, and then, you know, you talk for what, 50 or 60 years, so it got more developed later. And I'm wondering, I mean, the story, too, it sounds kind of mythological, is that the mode of enlightenment, all the teachings and all their incredible organization just popped into existence, which doesn't seem to be way works for most people. So could be just a story. And I'm wondering what scholars think about this. Do they, what's their opinion, which is probably going to be more informed than our opinion, which we just have an image of what the Buddha is like.
Yeah. That's an excellent point. And what I read, again, if you go to from a very orthodox monastic point of view, no, it comes up fully formed. And, you know, this was... you know, somebody who wasn't quite sure what they were doing. It's all over the place. Really, nobody knows. It's all conjecture on what's going on. Yeah.
In a way, it reminds me of the Psalms in the Bible, in that it is kind of almost a cry.
Yeah.
And it comes from a different place. I don't see anything that seems untrue in anything that's said here. It speaks in a different way. It speaks to the heart versus the head.
Exactly.
And much of what we read of the Buddha is so well organized and so well thought out. You know, sometimes it's oblique, but, you know, I mean, it speaks more to the mind than to the heart. And this really speaks to the heart, and I find it very... I find it accessible. I like it. And I think it doesn't matter who wrote it. I think what matters is how it speaks to you. From
I was feeling the same way. In fact, I feel like it's a reflection.
Yeah.
And a reflection is a good thing.
Yeah, I kind of liked it. I mean, when I first read it as a whole and reviewed as a whole, it was like, okay, this is like a succinct whole dharma. You know, this is the whole dharma right here. Very succinct and everything. And the idea of an immature Buddha kind of rings for me more like a Buddha who got it all, maybe all at once, maybe not, but then learned how to teach it and describe it out in detail in all the other suttas. Because every verse has just a huge amount of stuff that we've been learning here for as long as we've been coming here.
Diane.
Yeah.
It strikes me, right after he was enlightened and he didn't know if he was going to teach, because he said that people have so much dust in their eyes. This feels like the guy that just sat through that horrible night with all the dancing girls and all the devils and all the thunder and all the fire, and the guy that worked for 7 years who didn't take anybody's word for anything, who tested everything, who almost killed himself doing all this teaching. This feels very visceral, like he knew what he was talking about in a way that you don't, you're right, maybe you don't hear it. It's a little bit more, I don't know, peaceful later sometimes, not always.
Yeah.
But it sounds like somebody who knew what he was talking about.
Well, it gets very academic later on. Very
it's hard
organized.
To know if that's the overlay of thousands of years or not.
That's exactly what scholars say. They said it doesn't mean that, at least the scholars and the translators I've read, doesn't mean that this is better. It means it's raw. And it was extrapolated, you know, as time went on and people codified what was taking place. Yes.
Margaret.
Margaret. Where is Margaret? Margaret, I'm sorry.
There were just two things. One of the lines that I heard, I didn't read it, but just like the arrow references other teachings, then there's the line of do nothing except in this it, that you may reprove, mm-hmm. and in the Meta Sutta is that the wise may not reprove.
Exactly.
Very interesting. But I don't see that it has to be a dichotomy, because after all, think of Thich Nhat Hanh, who does wonderful teachings and beautiful poetry. And so if the poetry comes out of that raw feeling and the raw enlightenment, mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that it wasn't the Buddha that did it. He would be both souls. He would be both. Mm-hmm.
Well, Stephen Batchelor doesn't believe it's the Buddha. His feeling is it's a monk. I mean, it's one opinion, you know, of many. He feels it was a monk who was new at practice and struggling tremendously. And he actually doesn't even know if it was a man. He said it could have been a woman. I didn't know this, but the third, what do you call it? I can't speak in grammar terms, but in Pali, there's no way of telling the third person if it is a male or female. Mm-hmm. And this is written in the third person. So he feels that it could have been a man or woman, and it could have been a lay person or, you know, anybody.
And it could have. I mean, I do agree it sort of doesn't matter. It still is.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You had said that this actually sort of was born out of the second noble truth. And so
no, I said I see the second noble truth in here.
I do too.
It's in its raw form.
Yeah, there was an evolution, you know, of this practice. You know, so you said some came from the Vedas,
mm-hmm.
and we were talking about this this evolution, you know, over time where the this defines the problem. The problem is, you know, the what are they called? You know, when you have these things that you have to work with. But mindfulness now has not really, and awareness hasn't really been presented here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're just identifying, you know, these qualities that and there's the Eightfold Path, which is the way to work through this, you know, very likely hadn't been conceived.
Right.
And so that's why for me this is very limiting, and it's off-putting somewhat because of its but this is also the evolution of consciousness. I mean, I once read a book years and years ago about the breakdown of the bicameral mind in the evolution of consciousness, you know, way back in the days when you would be wanting to know this, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's just fascinating. It's I really appreciate you bringing this, you know, taking us back really to the genesis in some way.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with you that I don't think it's the Buddha, because it sounds like a...
Not me, okay. Stephen Batchelor. I don't know.
It sounds like a first-year college student that just took, like, a Native American studies or a class where he or she realized all the things that they learned in high school were wrong, and then they're going around telling everybody, don't eat meat, or don't eat this, or we killed all this, or we did this. So they're kind of judgmental and rude and kind of negative. That's kind of seems like that to me. And then I noticed that surely one isn't liberated by others.
Yes.
This is before the separation between the Hinayana and Mahayana, right? So
yes.
He's talking about a bodhisattva ideal, I would think, if he says one isn't liberated by others, because that would be the choice that you would take, is liberation for yourself or liberation for all humanity if you're a bodhisattva. So is there something going on with that I saw? Or?
I don't think so, but I'm not a scholar. I think, I was talking with Rich about this, because in other translations, and what you just said, surely one isn't liberated by others, I was taken by that, because other translations, it's not a question.
Mm-hmm.
It's a, you are not liberated by others.
Right,
Gill framed it as a question. which I think is really, really interesting. Surely one isn't liberated by others.
Because there's either a split or there's not a split. That sounds like there's allowing for a split when you say surely they're not liberated. If you said they're not liberated by others, then you're,
right.
You know what I mean, you're a greater vehicle.
Well, this actually was a radical statement because Brahmanism was being practiced in India at the time, and you had to go through rites and rituals, and you had to go through people who had the power to change things.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like, yes, this is the beginning of questioning that, but it's still a question. Gil, for whatever reason, and something in his translation, he saw this more as a genesis of questioning this. The Bodhisattva ideal was not around at this point.
Yeah, that's what that kind of struck me, because I saw liberation, I'm thinking Bodhisattva.
No, that happened 300 or 400 years after the Buddha died, when the different sects of Buddhism came into being. So, Barb?
Well, I'll go back to the stylistic. I think Margaret mentioned the Metta Sutta, and if you look at the last verse, it really is reminiscent of the style in the Metta Sutta. I can't quote it now, but that last verse is, you know.
And the Metta Sutta is actually in the Sutta Nipata.
Yeah.
So it is one of the very earliest suttas there is. And it's also in verse,
right.
As you see. And the Dhammapada, everybody know what the Dhammapada is? Mm-hmm. This is one of the really beloved books of the Pali Canon. And these are short verses as well. And this was also found in the the Sutta Nipata. So again, you can almost tell if it's verse-like that it's very, very old. It's ancient, and this is one of the most ancient of them. I also notice on this one, we haven't done the other two verses, but the other one is called the very first one is called, and tell me if this sounds familiar, the Kama Sutta. Does that sound familiar?
Yes,
the Kama Sutra. And it's the Pali version of Kama Sutra. And Kama in Pali means sensuous desire. You know, so it's a verse on sensuous desire. The one prior to this one goes into sensuous desire and collecting things. And it names the various things that people collect and think it's going to bring them happiness, possessions, slaves, women, horses, cattle, houses, and says none of these will make you happy. Mm-hmm. This sutta then goes into much more the mental attitudes of wanting those things, not the things themselves, but that desire, that wish to have it, which is just as harmful as gathering all these things and thinking, now I'll be happy. If I only have these things, now I'll be happy. There's really no difference, at least in my mind. I don't see it. And then I'm wondering, when he talks about the wise, who are the wise? Who are the people that he goes to?
In the Metta Sutta, the wise are clinging to something.
Clinging to nothing.
Yeah.
Not having any view.
Right.
That's right. Coming completely back around. I had a couple other notes on some of this that I wanted to ask you too. Okay. In the third verses, what will become of us when we pass from here? Now, he mentions this a couple times. Death, what will become of us? What is he saying here? Because according to Gil, and actually according to all the translations I read, this is not concerned with rebirth. This is concerned with right now. And Gil says in his commentary, and even if rebirth is brought in, He's talking about right now. What you do right now affects everything. So you can believe or not believe in rebirth, doesn't matter. You got to take care of business right now. So what will become of us when we pass from here? Is what is he saying there if we're just concerned about right now?
Yeah, but this is, he said, presented with suffering, they lament. So he's talking about what happens to people who are so attached to sensual desire, you know, any sort of sensual pleasure.
Yeah, right.
Stingy, attached, obsessed with desires, wedded to disharmony. what's going to happen? You know, we don't have all our stuff, or we have all our stuff. Where's it going to go? What's going to happen?
Yes, right.
And an inclusion of some of the discourse that was very popular in the day, especially if you stick with the idea that maybe it wasn't the Buddha thinking about those things and coming out of a culture that was very much into discourse and thinking about those things, it seems reasonable that someone else would have it on their mind and would include it in the verse.
Yeah.
I heard the what will become of us as another form of clinging to the self that we are now, that we think is so solid, and that all of the different things were different ways that we cling, all of which take us out of the freedom
exactly.
of the moment.
I agree with you. Worried about what will become of us is another form of clinging. And whoever talked about Thich Nhat Hanh, one of the statements he made, which I've always appreciated and I've mentioned here, he said, you take care of right now. Your last thought in this life will take care of the next. So you don't have to worry about the next. Take care of this. And that, to me, makes all the sense in the world. Don't worry about what comes now. Take care of it right now. And that's what this seems to be saying as well. There was another question. This one I found interesting, and I found an answer in another sutta, but don't do what is out of harmony in the world. What does that mean? You just go along with everything? Never question anything? What do you think?
You know, that music used to be considered it was perceived as the harmony of the spheres, that it was actually something that could be perceived. And so I'm just wondering, it seems that there's a balance.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's referring to balance.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you on that. There's another sutta, and I don't remember the sutta itself. Maybe Rich remembers, but the Buddha says, what the wise say is so, I too say it is so. What the wise say is not so, I too say it is not so. And I've always found that curious. It's almost like, again, not clinging to any view at all. And I'm wondering if that's what's started here. Yeah, Rich.
I'm wondering if he's, when he says what is out of harmony with the world, I mean, that's what Vipassana is about, right? It's about seeing things as they are. And so rather than see things through the filter of delusion, seeing things as they actually are is in harmony with the world. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I was thinking about was that definition of dukkha, you know, being the mm-hmm. axle that's mm-hmm. out of whack, and mm-hmm. so the ride is very bumpy and sort of out of harmony, and it's out of whack. And maybe it's talking about suffering.
Yeah.
Don't do things that will bring you suffering because they're out of touch with reality, with the way things really are.
Yeah. And this is like the bare essence of that, touching on that. Now take it further and even further and further. Yeah, I agree. Anybody else have anything?
I have a question. There was a phrase in there about lowly people. What was that phrase?
Lowly people weep in the face of death.
Lowly people what?
Weep in the face of death.
Why is he saying lonely people?
I don't know. That's why I brought this here to get your ideas on it.
It seemed to me like this, a similar as an instructed worldling.
Mm-hmm.
That's
yeah,
what I'm
yeah.
Like.
That could
yeah, yeah.
be.
Something untrained.
Yeah.
Could be talking about untouchables, too.
I don't think so. Because he let untouchables practice.
Yeah, there were no untouchables there. There was a different caste system, but he allowed all castes to join the Sangha.
What was right before that line about lonely people?
I see people thrashing about in the world, thirsting for states of existence, not freed from craving, becoming, and non-becoming. That's where I see the second noble truth. You know, it's Genesis. Lowly people weep in the face of death. Lowly people weep in the face of death. One thing that is really remarkable about this is at that time, people were not encouraged to look at their minds and start paying attention to what caused suffering. This was an incredibly liberating thing for someone to encourage this. And ironically, when I was reading these, I've gotten on this kick of reading the Before I Die, I Want to Read the 100 Greatest Novels Ever Written. And so I've read a lot of Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and Thomas Hardy. And I finished as I was reading this or working on this. I don't know if you've heard of Thomas Hardy's Jude the Obscure.
Yeah.
Everybody know the story about Jude the Obscure?
No.
This is it. And this is what was amazing. I just thought, boy, the synchronicity of this is incredible. Jude the Obscure was written in the 1880s by Thomas Hardy. And Jude is of a lowly caste in England, you know, the servile caste or whatever you would call it then, the service people. Mm-hmm. And he aspired to be a person that knew philosophy, could speak many languages. He just longed for this. And he taught himself Latin and Greek, and he studied everything he could. And then he wanted to go to, the town is called Christminster in England, because they had universities there. And there he would finally fulfill this longing to investigate how people think and why we think the way we do, and he did as much as he could on his own. He gets to Christminster in England and all the universities, and he is told, "You're of the servant class. We are not interested in helping you." And then the rest is just this horrible tragedy that just goes on because he's not given the chance. And as I'm reading this, I'm realizing, you know, how revolutionary that the Buddha was saying, yeah, come, you know, come, look at this, look at the suffering, speak about it. This could have been a disciple who was doing this, but it was unheard of at that time that anybody could come and have the luxury of looking at their own minds and what causes suffering. So I think this is why when Laura, I think, so eloquently said, this comes from the heart, it really does. And I could see it coming from an immature Buddha or somebody who just is finally looking at what is going on with me. Why am I never satisfied? What is going to bring me happiness? And struggling with it. So anyway, so my conclusion was whoever wrote this aspires to be alone yet wants a life of balance. And I think maybe that's what all of us try. We want solitude through retreats, through our sittings, but we also want to be in community, and we want to be with people who will support our practice, and that's why we're here. So I think that's it. It's 2:02. I'll do a final metta. So may our conversation tonight and may our contemplation over the important things in life, what we should be doing with our lives, how we should be treating others, may all of this be of service to ourselves and all living beings. May we in this room and may every living being everywhere have the opportunity to discover what causes happiness, what causes suffering, and may we learn to be happy through all of our efforts, and may all of our efforts be given freely to every living being, that we all may be free and happy in this lifetime.